It's time for us to begin our study this morning. If you would, please open your Bibles to 2 Kings chapter 24. 2 Kings chapter 24. We're continuing to talk about the closing period of the southern kingdom of Judah. We've already talked about the fall of the northern 10 tribes of Israel in 2 Kings chapter 17. And you would think that the southern kingdom could look at what happened to their brethren to the north and say, we don't want that to happen to us. But we now find that the kings in the southern kingdom had developed essentially the same attitude of disregard and apathy toward what the prophets are telling them. And they're engaged in the practice of idolatry, and the condemnation of God is soon to come upon them. When we study from this period of Old Testament history, we need to continually be reminded, as the Apostle Paul wrote in Romans chapter 15 and verse 4, that the things that were written aforetime are written for our learning. That's one of the reasons why we're studying this. I've had two or three folks, several in the last few years, to make the observation that they really didn't have an appreciation for Old Testament history or see any place for it, particularly in our study, until classes like this, because then it makes the Bible come together. And I think that's very important for us to see, that the Bible is not just a bunch of individual stories, but rather it is the revelation of the scheme of redemption, God's plan to save us. And we know that He had that plan in mind before time's eternal, the New Testament tells us. And when we see the fall of Adam and Eve in Genesis chapter 3 and the promise of God that through the seed of woman, the head of the serpent would be crushed, we see long periods of silence, but little bits and pieces then given relative to that promise over generations of time. And we come from Genesis 3 to Genesis 12, a period that encompasses over 40 generations, a period that encompasses the days of the flood. And we see another glimpse of God's plan to save man as God speaks to Abraham and says, in thy seed shall all families of the earth be blessed. We noted at the time Abraham didn't have any children. Abraham was an old man. But believing what God said, a promised son finally came. And when the boy was a lad, Abraham took him upon the mountain and was preparing to slay him, as God had said, believing that God could raise him from the dead and still make of him a great nation, and still give to his descendants this particular land that he had promised and defined the boundaries of, and still in his seed bless all families of the earth in the forgiveness of their sins. Now, to what degree Abraham understood all of that, I don't know. But he believed what God said. He believed that God would keep his promise. And then from that point forward, we have, kind of like a rock skipping across the pond, looked at some of this Old Testament history. And we've come to the period that most folks just jump over, the period of the kings. Jump over thinking, well, that's not interesting, that's boring, and I can't pronounce all of those names, and it's not relevant to my salvation anyway, so we just jump over that. And I beg to differ. I think it's one of the most exciting periods in Old Testament history. As we talk about the period of the kings, noting that Moses had told them that the day will come when you will ask for a king. And when you appoint a king, this is the king or the kind of king you shall appoint. And Moses had told them that when you come into the land, you're not going to be faithful to God. And when you turn away from God, God's going to take you out of the land and He'll destroy you. But when you repent, God will bring you back into the land. And we saw all of that in Deuteronomy 4, Deuteronomy 8, Deuteronomy 28 through 30, and specifically Deuteronomy chapter 30, and in verses 1 through 10. Now, as we saw the development of this in the days of the judges, during a time when they have rebelled against God for over 300 years, and God has sent a deliverer after deliverer after deliverer to them to turn them around. But during the days of the last of the judges, Samuel, the people did just exactly what Moses said. We want a king so that we can be like the nations round about them. Saul became their first king. Then David became their second king, and Solomon, the son of David, became their third king, each reigning for 40 years. During the days of David, God renewed his promise and said unto David in 2 Samuel chapter 7, beginning in verse 14 down through verse 16, I will establish your throne forever. Now we know that he was talking about the coming of the Son of God, the coming of Jesus. That Jesus would be of the lineage of David. Now we know that because we have Peter's explanation of that in Acts chapter 2. But to bring us then to Solomon's son, Rehoboam, the kingdom divided. The character by the name of Jeroboam became the first king then of the now divided northern empire. From this point, we talk about the nation of Israel. And the southern kingdom, the lineage of the kings from David, pursue in the southern kingdom. And as we talk about the southern kingdom, they're identified as Judah. Long list of kings in the northern kingdom. Jeroboam did what? We always note Jeroboam because he introduced something that other kings kept coming back to and coming back to, even in the southern kingdom. Calf worship, that's right. As he set up an altar in Dan and one in Bethel, saying it's too much for you to go down there to Jerusalem to worship. Go to Dan, go to Bethel. And so we see that idolatry, calf worship, was introduced now in among these people in the northern kingdom, specifically by Jeroboam. One of the characteristics of all the kings of the northern kingdom, what was it? Evil. Every single one of them. You don't have to make a decision when you're looking at the list of kings as to which ones were good or bad. They were all bad. Every one of them. And then we read in 2 Kings chapter 17 regarding the close of the northern kingdom during the reign of the king Hoshea, who was defeated by the king of Assyria. And that begins a new segment of our study. Because with the close of the northern kingdom, now we're following the kings of the southern kingdom. And Hezekiah was reigning when the northern kingdom was taken captive by the Assyrians. The king of Assyria challenged Hezekiah, pointing out to he and the people, or to him and the people, just how foolish he was to trust in God. Affirming that, look at all these other nations and their gods, they could not be delivered. What makes you think that God's going to deliver you? And Hezekiah's faith and confidence was in God. And what happened, Richard, to Sennacherib's army? I like the way you say that.
I got it from you.
That may be why I like it.
Well, yeah, that's one morning, 185,000. His guys woke up dead.
They did. And so Randy, wrapped up his ball of yarn and went back to Nineveh, where his two sons killed him, just like he had been told that this would happen. Now, when you see these things occurring, just as the prophets said, as they had said hundreds of years beforehand, does that impress you that the Bible is not a book of myths? It could not be written by men and maintain such consistency as we see the Bible written by over 40 different men over a period of about 1,600 years. How do you explain the consistency of the story if it didn't come from God? So when we look at this history, it's significant that we be impressed with the authenticity of the Bible, the authority of the Bible. But it's also important that we be impressed with the necessity of the events in the place in history that they occurred to bring about the promised seed, to bring Jesus into the world, whereby we might enjoy salvation. Now, as we're studying in 2 Kings chapter 24, we're talking about the fall of the southern kingdom. And we note that the prophet Jeremiah recognizes the evil things that the king Jehoiakim is doing, and he writes a roll, or he writes a book, if you please, and takes it to the people of Judah, specifically Jerusalem, and it is read before them. It is also taken before King Jehoiakim and read before him. And the warning of the prophet of God is, if you pursue this course, here's what the Babylonians are going to do to you. And what did Jehoiakim do to the book of the roll? He cut it up and threw it in the fire. Now what does that tell you his attitude was toward what God said? He didn't care. He's going to do it anyway. Now, Jeremiah's message is, when that happened and other events in history began to develop, Jeremiah reveals it's too late. It's just too late. The Babylonians are going to conquer you. Do you believe that it can be too late? You know, sometimes our attitude becomes such and our heart becomes so hard, it's too late. Or circumstances exist that involve a whole lot of other people that make it next to impossible for us to stop the chain of reaction. And that's difficult sometimes for us to admit. When I was first preaching in Missouri, a lady that lived across the street from us, she was a member of the church where I preached, and she had an uncle that was dying in the hospital of lung cancer. And he wanted to talk to a preacher. Well, the man in the community had a reputation of being a very reprobate man, and now he's lying in the hospital dying of lung cancer. Well, he didn't have many days left, but his ability to think, to be conscious, was impaired because of the pain that he was in. It was impaired because of the meds they were giving him. And so he was in and out of consciousness. One of the things that you have noted is that each instance of conversion in the New Testament, there was always teaching that took place. Here is a man who has waited too late. Jehoiakim had waited too late. He was not turning around. Keep in mind, he was the son of the best king of the southern kingdom since the time of the division. He was the son of Josiah. He's appointed to be king by the Pharaoh of Egypt. He did a lot of things for the Pharaoh of Egypt. He taxed the people of God, and he gave those things unto Pharaoh. We know then that he served Nebuchadnezzar for a period of time, 3 years, and then he decided that he didn't want to do that anymore. But God raised up bands of Chaldeans and the Arameans and Moabites and the Ammonites, and they came up against Judah. Notice, if you will, in the text in chapter 24, in verse 2, the writer says, "And Jehovah sent against him bands of the Chaldeans, and bands of the Syrians, and bands of the Moabites, and bands of the children of Ammon, and sent them against Judah to destroy it, according to the word of Jehovah, which he spake by his servants, the prophets." Now, did they have reason to know that this was coming? When you go back and look during the days of Manasseh, in verse 27, the text tells us, of chapter 23, I'm sorry. It says, "And Jehovah said, I will remove Judah also out of my sight. As I have removed Israel, I will cast off this city which I have chosen, even Jerusalem and the house of which I said, my name shall be there. I'm going to destroy Jerusalem." Now here we have Jehoiakim, and he's rebelled against the Babylonians, but God raises up these bands of these people in order to destroy Judah, to bring it to its knees. And ultimately, the king of Babylon is going to take them. Now, when we look at Jehoiakim, we left off, I think, on this point somewhat so in our last study Wednesday night. And I want to review this with you just briefly. But if you'll turn over to the book of Jeremiah, you may even want to put a marker there, because we're going to keep coming back this morning to the book of Jeremiah. And notice what this prophet said during this period of time and what the attitude of the people was during this time. But in Jeremiah chapter 22, Richard, I believe you read this for us in our study Wednesday night, beginning in verse 13. Would you mind to read that again, please, down through verse 19?
22:13-19?
Yes, please.
"Woe unto him that buildeth his house by unrighteousness and his chambers by injustice, that useth his neighbor's service without wages and giveth him not his hire, that saith, I will build me a wide house and spacious chambers, and cutteth him out windows, and it is sealed with cedar and painted with vermilion. Shalt thou reign because thou strivest to excel in cedar? Did not thy father eat and drink and do justice and righteousness? Then it was well with him. He judged the cause of the poor and needy, then it was well. Was not this to know me, saith Jehovah? But thine eyes and thy heart are not but for thy covetousness, and for shedding innocent blood, and for oppression, and for violence to do it. Therefore thus saith Jehovah concerning Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, they shall not lament for him, saying, Ah, my brother, or Ah, sister. They shall not lament for him, saying, Ah, Lord, or Ah, his glory. He shall be buried with the burial of an ass, drawn and cast forth beyond the gates of Jerusalem.
That's graphic, isn't it? Here's what's going to happen to you. Now, the point of contrast is fascinating as well. When Jeremiah speaks concerning what his father did, who was his father? Josiah. That's right. And Josiah was faithful to the Lord. We note that Josiah was responsible for many of the reforms and restorations that took place in the temple. And he did that, the text tells us in verse 16, in order to know me, saith Jehovah. But then in verse 17, what about you, Jehoiakim? Where's your interest lie? Dishonest gain, shedding innocent blood. Jehoiakim is selfish. He's not interested in serving the Lord. He's interested in serving self. Now here's the miserable end of this king. You're going to be buried with the burial of an ass, drawn and cast forth beyond the gates of Jerusalem. You're going to be buried like an animal. Now, we talked about the honorable burial of kings. And the text tells us, and I ask you to make note of that as you read concerning the end of these kings. Some were buried outside the gates of the city. Some, the text just simply tells us, they were buried, but not with the kings. Some, we read, were buried in the sepulcher of their fathers. They were buried with honor in the place of the kings. That was not this man. But it was his father, Josiah. But it was not his son, Jehoiakim. He was to be buried outside the gates, just like an animal would be buried. Now, as we continue to talk this morning about Jehoiakim, we noted, I believe, in some of our closing remarks very hurriedly, that Egypt, who had become a partner to the kingdom of Judah, now does not seek to help. Why? You've heard the expression, the handwriting on the wall. What is it that Egypt can see? We're going to look at that expression a little further down the pipe.
Well, they can see Babylon coming down.
They can see Babylon coming down. In fact, if you'll notice in this text, that's not the text. I'm looking at Jeremiah. Turn the page, Mick. Yes, go back to 2 Kings, chapter 24, in verse 7. It says, And the king of Egypt came not again any more out of his land, for the king of Babylon had taken from the brook of Egypt unto the river Euphrates all that pertained to the king of Egypt. Now the king of Egypt, he thinks he's got some hold in the land of Judah. But when we talk about the king of Babylon, what does the king of Egypt recognize? Notice the borders that are defined here. Very significant. The Babylonians now have taken from the brook of Egypt unto the river Euphrates. Let's see, who can I pick on? Larry, you feel like doing some reading for me? How about back in Genesis chapter 15? Genesis chapter 15. Pick it up, if you will, at verse 18 and read down through verse 18 will get it. We don't have to identify all those inhabitants. Verse 18, Genesis 15, 18. All right, notice, if you will, the borders of this land. We've defined that well on the map many times in our past study. And we've seen the river Euphrates up to the north and to the east, and the river of Egypt down here to the south and to the west. And we see that here used to define the borders of the land that God promised to Abraham. We saw that during the days of Joshua, they came in and they conquered that land from the river Euphrates to the river of Egypt. And we saw that during the days of King David, that he went to recover a lost portion of the land unto the river Euphrates. And we saw that Solomon ruled over all the land that God had promised from the river Euphrates to the river Egypt of Egypt. And he gathered taxes from not only those portions of the land, but even outside the borders of that land. But now we see that the Assyrians have taken the land from the river of Egypt to the river Euphrates. What does that tell you? The Babylonians. What did I say? The Assyrians. The Babylonians. Thank you. Always like to know what I said, so I know I was wrong.
We'll find it on the recording.
I'll find it on the recording, yes. I'm sure I will.
Well, it indicates that Israel has lost Egypt, and now Egypt is about to lose it to Babylon. So it's completely lost.
Yeah. Basically, all that's left at this point is the conquering of the city of Jerusalem, the capital. And so the other cities have gone. And this is what God said, precisely what God said would occur. Now, in our study, turn, if you will, a very significant passage back over to Jeremiah. I said we were going to go back and forth some here with Jeremiah because he was the prophet to the people of Judah during this period of time. And in Jeremiah chapter 25, Jeremiah was very specific about what's going to happen to them. Jeremiah chapter 25, reading beginning at verse 8. John, would you read for me, please, down through verse 12. Jeremiah 25, 8 through 12.
Therefore, this says the Lord of hosts, because you have not obeyed my words, behold, I will send and take all the counties of the north, declares the Lord. And I will send to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, my servant, I will bring them against this land and against its inhabitants, and against all these nations round about, and I will utterly destroy them, and make them a horror and a hissing and an everlasting desolation. Moreover, I will take from them the voice of joy and the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom and the voice of the bride, the sound of the millstones and the light of the lamp. This whole land will be a desolation and a horror, and these nations will serve the king of Babylon 70 years. Then it will be when the 70 years are complete, it will punish the king of Babylon and send that nation, declares the Lord, for their iniquity and the land of the Chaldeans, and it will make an everlasting desolation.
All right, God said through the prophet Jeremiah, the Babylonians are going to conquer you. When we read concerning the building of the temple, when we read concerning the people conquering the land, for example, we see days of rejoicing, wonderful days for the people of Israel. But now Jeremiah says the day is going to come when there's not going to be any laughing. There's not going to be any singing. There's another day in Israel. And it's not going to be a happy one because the Babylonians are going to conquer you and they'll leave you a desolation for 70 years. Well, wasn't that what Moses told them way, way back there, hundreds of years before? Here's what I'm going to do to you if you worship and serve idols. It's already happened to the northern kingdom. And now the southern kingdom, it seems, just can't wait for their turn. And so it is. Jeremiah assures them that the Babylonians are coming. Now, in Jeremiah chapter 36, Randy, this is where we noted that Jehoiakim burned the roll of the words of God. As Jeremiah was given the revelation of God to take it to Jehoiakim and warn him of these things that were to come. And Jehoiakim's attitude was, I am not afraid. Look at verse 24 of chapter 36. I would encourage all of you to read the whole chapter, chapter 36. But in verse 24, after he cut up the roll and threw it into the fire, it says, and they were not afraid, nor rent their garments, neither the king nor any of his servants that heard all these words. Jeremiah's words are graphic. Go back and read the chapter. He's telling the king precisely what's going to happen. And he just cut it up and threw it in the fire and was not afraid. Now, let me ask you, my friends, would you be afraid? God's manifested His presence more than once. The judgment of God came upon the northern kingdom. And now here it's in the history books, what God has done. Now, one of the things that we're going to note a number of times is when we project forward and note that Daniel and Ezekiel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were among those who were faithful who were taken into captivity by the Babylonians. The expression "that you may know" occurs how many times in the book of Ezekiel? 63 times in the book of Ezekiel. Now remember that Ezekiel is writing in captivity. He's one of the common fellows in captivity. Daniel is one of the fellows that is in the house of the king. But Ezekiel writes all these things and rehearses some of the things that has happened to them, "that ye may know that I am Jehovah." Well, somehow they've missed that for generations. And through the reign of these wicked kings, they've missed that. We noted in our study from Jeremiah chapter 27 and in verse 22, Jeremiah 27, verse 22. And you can just turn the pages through Jeremiah and find numerous readings where Jeremiah tells them, here's what's coming. But he promises to them a restoration. In verse 22, they shall be carried to Babylon, and there shall they be until the day that I visit them, saith Jehovah. Then will I bring them up and restore them to this place. Wasn't that what Moses told them way back hundreds of years ago in Deuteronomy chapter 30? And we noted there that their restoration was contingent upon them knowing God and knowing the book of the law and submitting to the words of the book of the law. Deuteronomy chapter 30 in verse 10. Now one of the things that we did note on a sidetrack Wednesday night is that when you talk to premillennialists today who believe that at the second coming of the Lord there's going to be some kind of mass exodus of Jews from wherever they are on the globe, and they'll go into the land of Canaan and they'll be restored. When we saw the things necessary for a restoration according to the promise of Moses, they were to keep the commandments and statutes contained in the book of the law. Look at that. Deuteronomy 30, verse 10. And the New Testament says, not ever going to be under the law again. Not ever going to have the genealogies anymore. We noted that they were destroyed during the days of Titus, the Roman general who destroyed Jerusalem in 70 AD. And as far as the priesthood is concerned, you can't have that without the law and without the books of the genealogy. So what does the New Testament say about a future restoration of Israel? Not going to be one. No, not going to be one. In fact, it says there's not going to be one. Okay? There's just not going to be one. Now, as we hold our finger here in Jeremiah, I want us to note, as we talk about restoration, what the prophet Isaiah had said. In Isaiah chapter 44, drop down toward the end of Isaiah 44. Yes, what?
Just a random question on Jeremiah 26.
Okay.
As far as I know, in any of the ones, he never refers to anybody as his servant. Right? He says that I will use this person as a tool to punish you guys. But he actually refers to Nebuchadnezzar as his servant.
Yep.
Does that mean that he was loyal to him
no.
at this point? Or,
no.
Because, I mean, he talks about punishing him later, but,
yeah.
but he just calls him his servant. That's kind of weird to me that he doesn't call, as far as I can remember, he doesn't call any of the other oppressors
yeah.
his servant.
When I said no, perhaps I said that too rapidly. Nebuchadnezzar had to learn in the midst of a world of idolatry that there is one God. You remember when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace? What caused that? Nebuchadnezzar had built an image, and he had commanded that at the sound of the musical instruments, whoever did not bow down to the musical, to the image that he had built, would be cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Well, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would not do that. They wouldn't bow down. And so he asked the question, is it of purpose? Is it an oversight that you've not done that? And they said, we have no need to answer you. the God of our fathers, will deliver us from you. And if not, we still will not bow down to the golden image that you've set up. And they were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And when they came out, what condition were they in? Perfectly fine. And what had Nebuchadnezzar learned? What did he declare? He set forth a decree. What was it? If you'd like.
Daniel chapter 4, beginning of verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar the king knew all the peoples and nations, the men of every language that lived in all the earth, and made a peace of power. And it seemed good to me to declare the signs and wonders which the Most High God has done for me. How great are his signs, and how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation.
Okay. Nebuchadnezzar has learned that. And he finally makes a decree that whoever speaks ugly things about the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, what's going to happen to him?
Oh, that's up there in chapter 3.
Chapter 3, yeah. Yeah, verse 28, 29. Yeah. He's going to be cut into pieces. And their houses, verse 29, shall be made a dunghill, because there is no other God that is able to deliver after this sort. Now, in answer to your question about Nebuchadnezzar, we see that about him here. But then later, Nebuchadnezzar, he's kind of hard to convince. He has to learn the hard way that God rules, one God, and he rules in the kingdoms of men. And so the prophet Daniel told him that the day is going to come when your nails are going to grow out like bird claws. You're going to be scratching around in the grass and eating like a cow. Till you learn that God rules. And what happened to Nebuchadnezzar? That's exactly what he did. And it tells us in chapter 4, verse 34, "And at the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes unto heaven, and mine understanding returned to me. And I blessed the Most High, and I praised and honored him that liveth forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom from generation to generation." So Nebuchadnezzar kind of begins to catch on to things. And that may be why he's referred to as the servant of God. But he certainly was a tool that God used.
Is that the only time he ever does that to like an impressive person like that? Because Nebuchadnezzar seems like he got some special treatment that God kept saying, "Come back to me, come to me, come to me." But some of the other ones, like the pharaohs, never seemed to have that happen. They just got destroyed, or the Assyrians just got destroyed. Nobody ever like was taught a lesson. They were just destroyed.
Well, you know, it's pretty easy to teach somebody who's willing to look at the evidence. Even somebody who might be somewhat contrary, if he's finally willing to look at the evidence, he can learn something. But when you take, for example, Pharaoh, king of Egypt at the time of Moses, when you look at the plagues that were brought upon him and see the power of each plague over the gods of the Egyptians, what was the attitude of Pharaoh? He ever get the point? Never did really get the point. And so you can look at the evidence and be persuaded, or you can look at the evidence and not be persuaded. That's your choice. And I think that's what we see here with Nebuchadnezzar. Now, strangely enough, with Nebuchadnezzar's son, what happened with him?
Belshazzar?
That would be Belshazzar. Yes. What happened with him?
He saw the handwriting on the wall.
That's the fellow. He saw the handwriting on the wall. And did he learn the lesson? No. He didn't get it. Alright? So all these things I think are significant. Now, does that answer somewhat your question? When we look back over in Isaiah now, to take a step back to chapter 44 and 45, look at what Isaiah had said about the destruction of the people of God and the restoration of the people of God. In verse 27, well, let's begin at verse 24 of chapter 44. Isaiah 44, verse 24. It says, "Thus saith Jehovah, thy Redeemer, and he that formed thee from the womb, I am Jehovah that maketh all things, that stretcheth forth the heavens alone, and spreadeth abroad the earth, who is with me. and frustrateth the signs of the liars, and maketh diviners mad, that turneth wise men backward, and maketh their knowledge foolish, that confirmeth the word of his servant, and performeth the counsel of his messengers, that saith of Jerusalem, she shall be inhabited, and of the cities of Judah, they shall be built, and I will raise up the waste places thereof. That saith unto the deep, be dry, and I will dry up thy rivers. That saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd, and shall perform all my pleasure. Even saying of Jerusalem, she shall be built, and of the temple thy foundation shall be laid. Thus saith Jehovah to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden to subdue nations before him, and I will loose the loins of kings to open the doors before him, and the gates shall not be shut. Oh, there's so many things in there that tempt me to talk about. When we talk about how that God is able to bring about, as he's affirming his greatness, bring about the counsel of his servants. When you think of the things that Jeremiah and Isaiah have prophesied about, and it all fell into place just exactly like God said. Just exactly.
When he says that it is I who says of Cyrus, he is my shepherd, and he will perform all my desire. Wasn't this written about 150 years before Cyrus?
That's exactly what I was going to ask. You see, Isaiah is writing before Cyrus was ever born. In fact, about 200 years before Cyrus was born. And the thing that is especially interesting is that Cyrus, though he's not born, there's not even a kingdom yet over which Cyrus might rule. The Medes and the Persians had not yet joined forces and conquered the Assyrians or the Babylonians. That hasn't occurred yet. No. Now Isaiah is writing all this way, way ahead. And he names the name of a man, specific man, and a kingdom over which that man will reign, obviously, before that kingdom is even established. And what is it that Cyrus is going to do? He's going to write a decree and you'll be restored. You'll go back to Jerusalem. The temple will be rebuilt. Now we're jumping ahead just a little bit, but we're looking now at restoration promises. And Isaiah is writing about those restoration promises. You see, Cyrus is going to be the one that I will cause nations to submit to. And I'll bring these things about. Now, when you read further during the time of restoration, I'm not going to go down this path much farther, but when you look at the books of Nehemiah and Ezra in particular, in Ezra chapter 1, who's reigning? Cyrus is. Yeah, Cyrus is. And he writes a decree and lets the people go home. And then when it comes time to rebuild the temple, we find that there is oppression and objection by those who have become enemies of God's people. And they go before the king and they say, wait a minute, these people are living in rebellion to you. And he's reminded, no sir, that's what Cyrus decreed. And he orders that the Chronicles of the Kings be brought. He reads it and he finds the decree of Cyrus. He said, no sir, leave them alone. They're doing this by the decree of the Persian king. End of story. Well, at least that story. Okay? So when we talk about restoration, it was contingent upon them submitting to God's law. Now, we've talked about Jeremiah quite a little bit, and we've talked a little bit about Nebuchadnezzar. We need to talk a little bit about the besiegement of the city of Jerusalem and its fall, and note that Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and Jeremiah, and Ezekiel are taken captive by these kings of the other nation, the Babylonians. And so we want to see how that begins to come into place. Any questions or comments just here? Yes.
Let's say just for informational purposes, there are apparently 408 instances of the word servant in the American Standard Version. I just looked through a good portion of them, and it appears that Jeremiah is the only one that in three instances in three different chapters uses calls Nebuchadnezzar his servant.
That's interesting.
That's the only place where another person is called his servant.
Okay. Very good. Very good. I've not done that, but that,
really?
I'm glad you did. Thank you for doing that. Answers the question. Okay. Any other comment or question? All right, let's turn, if you will, in your Bible to Jeremiah once again. Let's look at Jeremiah chapter 36. Jeremiah chapter 36. In Jeremiah chapter 36, we read of the fall of, or the promised fall of the reign of Jehoiakim. We noted that Jeremiah was to take another role and present it to the king, and he was not really impressed by that either. And as we continue in this, that's not the chart I'm looking for. Here's the one I'm looking for. In the lineage of the kings, after Jehoiakim, we read about Jehoiachin. And Jehoiachin is another son of Josiah. Well, right here, Josiah. We've got Josiah's son, Jehoahaz, Josiah's son, Jehoiachin, and Josiah's son, Zedekiah, all of these sitting on the throne in Judah. Now, as we look at Jehoiachin, there's a bit of confusion that I want to throw out. I don't want you to be confused. But we know that Jehoiachin is also called by the name Coniah and Jeconiah. So write that down if you are writing in your lesson book or if you write in the margin of your Bible, so you'll know when you're reading from a variety of different places, such as Jeremiah 22. There are a number of instances. This is just one. And Jeconiah we have in 1 Chronicles 3. Again, a number of places he's called that. That we're talking about the same man.
The chart on 117 says Jehoiachin is the son of Jehoiakim.
Let me look. 117 where?
Under Jehoiachin, three lines down.
Uh-huh.
The son of Jehoiakim.
He is. Jehoiakim.
This says
okay.
Josiah.
I've got that wrong. I've got that wrong. It's Zedekiah, Jehoahaz, right here. Zedekiah, Jehoahaz, and Jehoiakim, right here. I should have that up one. Sorry about that. That goes up there. Okay. Look at my notes again. Yes. That's correct. I'm sorry. I have that in the wrong place on the chart. Any other comments or questions while we're paused? All right, let's talk a little bit about Jehoiachin or Coniah or Jeconiah. Very wicked king. Let's go back to the account given in the Kings in 2 Kings chapter 24. 2 Kings chapter 24. In 2 Kings chapter 24, you'll note in verse 8, it says, "And Jehoiachin was 18 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned in Jerusalem 3 months." If you're reading from the account in the Chronicles, Judy and David pointed this out to me last Wednesday night, and frankly, I've not really done a lot of research on that to have resolution of it, but in at least some translations, reading in the American Standard Translation, it identifies Jehoiachin in this text as 18 years old when he began to reign. And in the account in the Chronicles, it indicates that he's 8 years old when he began to reign. You can take that and work with it if you'd like. Yes?
Jimmy and I kind of talked about that because it was kind of funny. But if you're going to sit there and say that this person was very evil, I mean, how many really evil 8-year-olds are, well, I mean, more than normal, at least, that there are out there, you know. So I would say that 18 probably sounds a lot better as far as being able to be truly evil in the sight of the Lord. Because at 8, I mean, you would really have to have been doing a lot to really get that. So it kind of makes sense that probably 18 rather than 8 years.
Well, that's true. It introduces, when we see things like this in the text, the subject of biblical criticism, where 18 and 8 may look very much alike to a scribe that's making a copy, keeping in mind we don't have the text that was written by the fellow that wrote the Kings. We don't have the original Chronicles. What we have are copies, and so it's possible that a scribal error could occur and plus or minus 10 years or so. But it doesn't change what we're looking at. We're looking at a very evil king, the son of Jehoiakim. And we know that, as we read, that Nebuchadnezzar begins to besiege the city. Look at verse 10. Verse 10. It says it came to pass, or at that time rather, the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up to Jerusalem and the city was besieged. Now we've talked about what a besiegement is before. We talked about that as we studied about Samaria, when Samaria was besieged by the king of the Assyrian Empire. What do you do when you besiege a city? You put a circle around it. Yeah. Now, why is that so bad if you're inside the city?
No food in, no food out.
Yep.
You can't get in the ground.
Yep. That's right. That's right. Yes.
The reason, however, that Jerusalem was so difficult for them to besiege was because Hezekiah had put that tunnel in from the spring Gihon that brought the water directly into the city of Jerusalem. So that's why it was a tough city to take.
That's right. I'm so glad you brought that up. That's what made it such a tough city during the days of Joshua and why it was not taken, to be able to cut off their springs or their water supply. And we saw how that was finally accomplished during the days of David. And now, you're right, we've got a problem here with Nebuchadnezzar besieging the city. And an interesting observation that you made just there, that I meant to make when I was over in Isaiah 44 and 45 about Cyrus, the king of the Persian Empire. How, long before Cyrus was born, how did God say that Babylon would fall? Go back and look at those last few verses of Isaiah 44. Quite impressive. Just a little tidbit, just a little expression that just jumps off the page when you see it. Isaiah chapter 44. You have it there for me, Randy, the last verse.
44:28. Isaiah says of Cyrus, he is my shepherd, and he will perform all my desire. And he declares of Jerusalem, she will be built, and the temple of the foundation will be.
All right, I got you one verse too far. Back up to verse 27.
27. Isaiah says to the depth of the sea, be dried up, and I will make your rivers dry.
What's going to happen to Babylon?
They're going to stop up the Euphrates and go in that way.
That's exactly what Cyrus did. He rerouted the Euphrates River that ran through the city of Babylon. And he marched up the dry riverbed and took the city of Babylon. How did Isaiah know that before there was even such a man as Cyrus? How Babylon would fall.
Maybe God told him.
You think God told him? Indeed. And I tell you what, folks, when you're reading from the text, you need to be reminded of what you're reading. You're reading the Word of God, and you see that evidenced in prophecy. Yeah. Yeah. Very good observation. I'm done?
You are.
Oh. Okay. Wednesday night, we'll start talking about this man. Some more. Coniah.